Hi, I'm Keegan.
And I'm Madigan.
And you're listening to Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist. This is a podcast where we explore the world through our own personal feminist perspectives.
And I'm burping like crazy.
I'm sorry. I gave Madigan champagne. Or really, it's sparkling wine. It's not even champagne. Let's not be fancy. It's in a can.
It is in a can.
There's that.
I am like super belchy right now, so... There's going to be some fun editing happening here. Hopefully, I'm just, like, scared that I'm going to, like, say a word and it's going to, like, the burp is going to come out as I say the word.
Bold of you to assume I'll edit it out, but here we go.
Oh, shit, I'm not in charge of this one. Oh, God.
So, it is our second week of Black History Month. It is the third week, but for us, it is the second week of covering Black History Month on the show. And, we were trying to figure out what we wanted to do this week, and I realized that this topic is not exclusive to the Black community or the Black experience. A lot of my notes are to do with colorism in regards to African Americans.
I did that as well.
I will touch, or we will touch on colorism in other cultures, of course, because it is
very universal.
Yeah, it's not a singular cultural experience.
Yeah.
It's something that happens everywhere. But I do think that colorism in the United States, as it pertains to African Americans, is something that is very specific to our culture and legacy because of slavery.
Yes.
And so it's an interesting conversation to have within the context of that.
Exactly.
And that's why we wanted to talk about it this month.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's just start off with, you know, the good old definition
the
of
good old
colorism.
Definition. I didn't even write down a definition.
I copied this straight from Merriam-Webster.
Oh,
so,
good.
The definition of a colorism is prejudice or discrimination, especially within a racial or ethnic group, favoring people with lighter skin over those with darker skin. And writer Alice Walker defined it as colorism, the preferential or prejudicial treatment of same-race people based on skin color. And she said it continues to this day. She once wrote, "We cannot as a people progress for colorism like colonialism, sexism, and racism impedes us."
Yeah.
And I think that that's an important distinction, is it is typically within your own race or culture that there's this distinction made between the literal color of your skin tone. And I've actually heard it referred to, and I think the first time I heard it referred to as this was in the documentary Dark Girls, which I did not have time to rewatch before we did this episode, but I have watched in the past.
Okay.
And they called it horizontal racism. So it's kind of like...
It's within the same line of your race, but it's almost like a scale.
Yes.
I feel like. But it's interesting because although, from my perspective, it seems to take place within... a race. It's like a prejudice within a race. But because of the prejudice within that race, it's almost kind of allowing the prejudice then to spill out into the general population.
Right. Well, and largely...
And the way that, like, white people see black people and things like that.
And largely that is because in the African American community in particular, especially, right? Because, like, there's colorism, again, within a lot of cultures. But within the African American experience, it's more than just the color of your skin. It's also your features. Because very often what led people to be lighter skinned is cross
breeding?
that sounds like the wrong word.
It sounds horrible, but that's all I know how to say.
But yes, I mean.
Yeah, it is.
It is kind of that. It was the way that this kind of started in the United States was there was a culture of rape that would happen between white men who owned slaves and, you know, African women who were enslaved. And, what would happen was they would then give birth to biracial children. And then there became these kind of like links or ties. While most of the time the slave master would not acknowledge, almost never, would they acknowledge that that child was theirs.
Right.
There was still this familial tie, or there would be these
there
kinds
was, like,
of
preferential
connections.
Treatment.
So what would happen is they would take them and they would keep them in the house, and then they became house slaves.
Yeah.
And people of darker skin who maybe weren't involved in this situation, they would be field slaves.
Yeah.
And so the way that they were treated became very different. And so then they became this kind of like social class that was attached to people with lighter skin because they had the better jobs. And, you know, it seemed more desirable to have people with European features, more European features.
To be in the home.
To be around. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I was trying to explain to my mom last night the one drop rule because I know somebody who is Hispanic and very dark skinned, actually, and had a baby with someone who is like Irish Jewish. Mm-hmm. And their baby is white, mm-hmm. has blonde hair, blue eyes, like doesn't look anything like the mother. And my mom was asking, well, like, what would it be like for that girl then? Because she doesn't look that way. And I didn't do any research on this, but I do remember talking about, like, what is it called? The one drop rule, where it's like if you have any Black or any Hispanic mm-hmm. in you, that's who you have to identify as.
Right. It was specific to, I totally believe it's probably bled into other cultures.
But I think originally it was from the slave time.
Right. It pertains specifically to African Americans. Yeah. But I'm sure that is a thing that all mixed race people feel.
Yeah.
And I do think that there is a situation of like, well, what do you look like? That's the thing about colorism that makes it the most interesting is like, really, race is a thing that can be kind of ambiguous.
Yeah.
Like, you kind of have to ask a lot of the time. Like, sometimes.
Especially today, mm-hmm. because we're getting so, more and more diverse.
Exactly.
And mixed,
we're
know?
So intermixed that a lot of times race is very ambiguous, whereas skin color is the first thing you see.
Right.
And, like, the first thing that you notice. So you can make judgments based on skin color. So if you are white passing, if you're a white passing person of color, your experience through life is going to be different than if you are not.
Yeah, and I actually read a quote from a Time magazine article that said just that. You know, we are very visual
creatures. I read
creatures.
The same thing. In fact, yeah. I think I have it.
I don't have it written down anymore because I didn't like how it was said. But yeah, I mean, we do, as horrible as it is, when we see something that is maybe different than what we're used to, mm-hmm. or if we see something that is similar to what we are used to, our reactions to those two things are going to be different. We're immediately going to be attracted to what is more familiar to us.
Right.
It's
biological.
It is. And it's a problem because that's why you have to make sure that you're educating children, especially that there is that the color of your skin doesn't mean you're inherently good or bad.
Right. And when we start becoming a more multicultural society, mm-hmm. right, and hopefully, although it doesn't seem like that's what's happening, it will help to curb some of these, like, more racist tendencies we have when all of these cultures are intermixing and being around each other more. It is also human nature for us to find ways to divide ourselves. And one of those ways is skin tone, because that is something that is always going to exist. There's always going to be varying hues of people. There's always going to be ways to divide, right? It's just like skin tone or body size or facial structure. Like, are you pretty by societal standards or are you not? You know, like, there's always going to be these ways to kind of, like, split yourself up.
And I actually wanted to interject really quick because we're talking about colorism, but it got me thinking because I'm not a science gal. I'm not even a huge history gal when it comes to scientific stuff mm-hmm. or anything like that. So I basically just Googled, why do we have different skin tones? Mm-hmm. And it was, I'm sure when I'm saying this, everybody's laughing at me because I'm sure everybody knows this with me and I'm like the last to catch on.
No, stop it.
But it was interesting because I was learning more about, like, the archaic Homo sapiens, because originally, so we were all covered in hair.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 1.2 million years ago, we started evolving and the hair on our bodies started coming off.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, our skin was vulnerable to the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And it all had to do with our locations.
Yes,
so for
right.
a long time, everybody who was living in the South, their skin was darkening and darkening and darkening, like Southern, like, hemisphere.
Right.
Their skin is darkening and darkening and darkening. And as these archaic Homo sapiens start venturing north, their skins didn't need that same
protection.
Shield and not protection anymore.
It's
therefore,
why
they had a lighter tone of skin.
Yeah, it's why Black people don't age the same way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And don't burn as easily in the
right.
sun.
Yeah, there's more protection there.
Look at Keegan and I in 30 years. I'm going to look like an old hag and you're still going to be hot.
I don't know. I really don't know about that. I've got some fine lines creeping up on me. The amount of, like, stress, I'm like, Jesus. Like,
my smile lines. I'm like, what the fuck are
smile
these?
Smile lines are good.
I know, but I'm fucking 27. I'm like, what is this shit? I just found that fascinating. So I want to throw that in there really quick.
So yeah, so we were talking about kind of like the history of colorism and how it began, and that kind of mentality that white people, one, became more comfortable around lighter skinned black people or mixed race, biracial people, partially because you develop a different kind of bond with the people who are in your home every day than you would people who are outside. And also, they're doing a different kind of work that is considered to be more civilized, right? Like, they're doing the sewing and the tending to children and the cooking, and they're doing things like that rather than doing the actual hard labor outside. Right. So it gives you a different kind of mentality, and they look like you. So in some instances, because you're actually related.
Yeah, and I didn't do any research on this, but you brought up something when you were saying that, which made me think about education, because obviously the slaves were not allowed to have any sort of education. They would, you know, attempt to teach each other different things. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if just growing up in a slave owner's home, being around the kids or, you know, anything, just working for them, but in that environment, because there is a statistic that says that, you know, a lighter skinned black person and a darker skinned black person with the same, you know, degree, same capabilities, same educational level, they're more likely to choose to hire the light skinned black person. And I wonder if that's something that started back in that time as well, because maybe they were better spoken. Maybe they had other clothes or manners where that was perceived that way. Again, I didn't do any research on this. I'm just wondering if that's a thing.
Well, I think that that's because of a number of instances, and I did write some of them down. Okay. Because after slave times, like, okay, so first of all, like, during slave times, right? So let's just take Thomas Jefferson for instance.
Let's
right?
do it.
Let's do that. So his wife, Martha.
Yeah.
Martha's father fathered a number of children with a slave that he had. Essentially, he raped a slave and had a number of children. And one of those children was Sally Hemings. So
I didn't know they were like
sisters.
Somewhat related.
They're sisters.
Gross.
So Martha, whenever her father passed away or when she married Thomas Jefferson, she inherited her siblings.
Yeah.
Essentially, her half siblings. And so she brought them into Thomas Jefferson's home.
Did she know that they were half siblings?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
Yes, I'm fairly certain. In fact, a lot of people say that Sally Hemings and Martha looked similar.
Yeah.
So she brought them over, and then, of course, Thomas Jefferson,
couldn't
whenever Sally Hemings was 14, decided to start what history has called an affair, but we all know was...
is fucking rape.
Rape. So there was that, and so... because there was a familial tie there that they didn't acknowledge as, like, something that was actual, but there was this kind of weird situation.
A weird relationship between the family.
Right. So not only her half-siblings who went with her to Thomas Jefferson's home, but then whatever children came out of those whatever relationships that happened there, they were not only given good jobs, but the men would also be like valets and things like
right.
that. And they would oftentimes even be allowed to work for other white families. So they would be permitted to like leave and work. And sometimes were even given payment.
Yeah.
So they were developing different kinds of skills that would allow them to move into a different class after the emancipation happened.
Right. This is my question really quick, and I don't mean
yes.
to interrupt you.
No, you're
what
fine.
Was Martha thinking when Sally was pregnant?
I'm sure she was not happy.
Does she know?
I'm sure she knew.
She had to.
I'm
known.
Sure she knew. I think Sally Hemings had like 6 kids or some
it
shit.
It was a lot of kids.
Yeah. So I'm and
it's very awkward just explaining to a, at the time, 5-year-old when in Hamilton, Jefferson says, Sally, won't you open this or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, what's that? And I'm like,
Yeah. I mean, yes. And like also Sally Hemings' children, I'm sure, were very light skinned.
Yeah.
They were a quarter.
Yeah.
So
that's true.
It's, well, they may not have been, but it's quite likely that they were very
yeah.
light-skinned. So, I'm sure Martha knew something was happening.
Right.
And I think Thomas Jefferson even took Sally Hemings to Paris with him at one point. So I think she Gross. Had to have known.
That poor woman. That poor girl. She was 14.
Yeah, I mean, I think she was probably older by that point, but still. Well, yeah,
but it started at 14. Yes. When you're, and that's the thing that people forget sometimes, is that when your abuse starts young, there is something in your brain at times that will almost make you stay that age. Sometimes when there's a severe trauma at a certain age, it's almost like you can't develop mentally.
Who knows what Sally Hemings really thought of that situation, but it doesn't really matter because the power...
She's still a victim.
The power dynamics were such that she didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
She didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
She couldn't... Like, I hate when they frame it as, like, this love affair that happened. Yeah. I'm like, no. So after the emancipation, the dark and light division that had been perpetrated by white people, while they, of course, still had this belief that light skin was better for all those reasons we've just said, African Americans also began to base social classes on skin color. And this is kind of where that horizontal racism, this colorism starts creeping up.
Right.
Because up until this point, yes, oftentimes they were the most well-educated. They did have the jobs that they could try and get hired for, kind of like white-collar jobs, right? Like jobs within the home, valets, butlers, like rather than being sharecroppers. And so they developed a certain kind of status. And black people started creating blue vein societies, which is kind of like the paper bag test. There were all of these tests, right, to determine if you could join certain social clubs right. or fraternities or sororities.
Or be, like, hired for a job.
Yes, but within black communities themselves, like, yeah. if they would have these, like, social societies, and one of them was the Blue Vein Society, which is, like, if you can see your veins through your skin... then you're light enough. Both you and I pass. And there was the paper bag test, which was if you are lighter or darker than a paper bag. If you are lighter than a paper bag, you can join. If you are darker, you can't. There's also the silhouette test, which was when they would shine a light against your face and then look at the shadow that it cast on the wall. And if your profile resembled
a
white person, then you could join. If you looked very African in your profile, you could not join. They were all of these
things. I didn't
know
about that one.
Right, because it was more than just your skin color.
Yeah.
It was also this negative effect that European beauty standards have had on people of color.
Right.
And this was a big part of it. It's because, yes, you had more European features. I have more, like, I have a straighter, longer nose and, like, things like that because I have European ancestry. You know what I mean? And so that was, like, a big part of it.
And it's kind of like, there is something where it's like, I've noticed in the natural hair trend and things like that, where people are trying to kind of take back their power in a way of what makes them naturally beautiful and important and don't have to assimilate to those European standards.
Yeah, there was a really good TED Talk. I think it was like a college TED Talk from Stanford whenever I was doing the prep for this episode. And it was a woman, I will link it in the show notes, who was a dark-skinned black woman. And she was talking about how when Straight Outta Compton came out, she loved Straight Outta Compton, and she was looking at the casting notifications for it, and there was this A-girls, right? Like, A-girls, super classy, can't have weaves. B-girls must be light to medium skin tone. C-girls must have medium skin tone. D-girls, dark skin. Dark skin, natural
Gross.
Hair. You could have natural hair only if you were a D-girl. You were supposed to be, like, quote-unquote ghetto. Those were the ghetto girls. And these are the
Gross.
Messages that we're telling. You know, when we start getting into... I do want to go a little bit more into the history, but where this is going to end up at the end is the lasting effects that this has on people today. If you watch the documentary Dark Girls, which I really encourage everyone to do. It was on Netflix. It's not anymore, but I'm sure you can rent it for like $1.99 somewhere. But it was really affecting for me because I think whenever you're a person of color, you can sometimes get wrapped up in this idea that, like, yes, all these issues are about me. And then it is humbling as, like, a lighter skinned black person, I self-identify that way, biracial person, to see this other part of it that, like, you are not privy to.
Right.
And you can't speak on, I can't speak on their experience.
It's educational.
But watching these women talk about their experiences as not just Black women, but dark-skinned Black women, and watching them cry about the way that they've been treated within their own community as already marginalized people, and then feeling like men don't want to date me because I'm Black, I'm dark-skinned.
The statistics of that is horrifying.
It's horrifying, and it's true. So Black women are the most educated group in the country, in the United States, but they are the most uncoupled group in the United States. And it's also true that oftentimes Black men don't want to date dark-skinned women.
I remember hearing that a lot from, like, Black friends of mine.
Oh, yes. They want a light-skinned woman.
It's very weird.
It's very weird, and it's gross.
Yeah.
But you know what? It's also, it comes from years and years of history.
Yeah, it's like socialization. Like,
yes.
We've been conditioned to feel a certain way, but it's
a class thing.
And in a lot of, like, if we're looking outside of just the Black community in the United States, when you're looking at other countries, like, I'm thinking of, like, countries in Asia.
Yes.
Like, it very much is a class thing.
Yes.
Where I feel like, especially in the United States, because colorism has such ties to slavery, it also takes on a much deeper meaning.
Right. Well, and because after slavery, as we were saying, in order to join some of these societies, you had to be light-skinned. Of course, it continued to keep education.
They were trying to separate themselves to be able to get the best lives that they could for themselves and their families, which you can't necessarily fault them on, but at the same time, it's segregating yourself from community.
You can fault them on it a little bit, because I do think some of it had to do with this leftover feeling of superiority, right? Like, because for so long,
like, why should they be put in the same group when I was inside and you were outside?
Right.
Like, that kind of thing.
Right. And it's kind of the same thing as, like, I think I've talked about it before in this podcast, but how rich white people really kind of stoked the flames of the separation between whites and Blacks, because there was a time whenever poor white people saw poor Black people or slaves, and they were like, actually, we have more in common with each other than we do with rich white people. So why don't we band together? It's like, it's the same thing that's happening now. Anytime poor people start getting, like, this idea where they're like, hey, maybe it's the rich people that are the problem, right?
Yeah.
That they were like, hey, maybe we should get together. And that's when, like, rich white people were like, how can we make poor white people feel like they're better than poor Black people?
Oh, God, and look at us today.
And so then they could say, at least, they were poor.
Yeah.
But they could at least be like, but I'm
superior.
But I'm superior because I'm white. And so there was, I think, that same kind of mentality happened in the African-American community, where, like, after emancipation, they were like, yes, I'm Black, but I'm not that kind of Black. I'm still better than somebody. And they had that kind of mentality, and I think they wanted to hold on to that. And it's really fucked up.
Yeah.
But I do think there's a part of that that's, like, human nature of just being like,
right, and that's what I meant by saying I can't fault them, because it's that thing of, like, where you'll do the best for your family or for your cause, but at the same time,
for yourself.
And for yourself. But also, like, what is that gaining in the long run,
as a whole, for your people, not much.
Not
you know
much.
What I mean? And it's caused lasting damage within this community. But it's, I think that that's kind of, like, where it was coming from, like, originally.
Okay.
So this kind of continued to happen, like, where, like, light-skinned people had the best neighborhoods. They were able, because they could be less offensive to their white neighbors and things like that. So all of these neighborhoods started being kind of, like, inhabited by lighter-skinned Black people. And it continued on even through the early days of the NAACP, which I think we talked about before.
We've touched on that, yeah.
Yes, where, you know, these people who we look up to as, like,
heroes.
Du Bois, these people who we look up as, like, Black heroes and things from the early days of the NAACP. I mean, he was, like, a light-skinned Black man. And
right.
They kind of withheld this idea of colorism. And so
It's drawing parallels to me as well with the beginning of the feminist movement as well. It's deciding what cross you're willing to bear.
Or it may be even simpler than that, in that, like, they probably justified it in that, like, they could say, well, white people are more comfortable with us.
Right.
So let us go forth and make the way for you guys. And they made themselves feel better by saying that.
I think that's a lot of what the white suffragettes said in the beginning as well. Like, they'll listen to us if we talk about, you know, women's rights. They probably won't listen to you as much. So let us be the faces of this movement. And then eventually they were
and
just
pushed
out. And
we'll make it better for all of us, right?
Exactly. Like, but eventually they were just completely pushed out when they started making headway with the goals that they wanted to achieve.
Yeah. So even after that, you know, even going into segregation, light-skinned students... Okay, now we're recording in the dark because my light kept flickering, and so it was like, we had to make a decision. It was like, either deal with the flickering lights or just turn the lights off.
Keegan, so, when we do a Halloween episode next year, we have to record in the dark because this is spooky as fuck.
I'm very discombobulated at the moment. Okay, but, all right. you've got a low light happening. Very scary. Hold on. So even during segregation, light-skinned students received preferential treatment to that of darker-skinned students, and they were therefore given better educations. Again, like, all of this goes into years and decades of advantages that light-skinned people had over dark-skinned people. Researchers have documented the ways in which many black teachers in segregated schools during pre-Brown versus Board of Education era were infected with the attitudes that preferred lighter-skinned children over dark-skinned students. Light-skinned students were selected as leads in plays and pageants, called on first in classroom discussions, and visibly favored by teachers. And that's something that, as a light-skinned person going on vacation with my black family, where we run the gamut of, like,
skin
brown,
yeah.
right? Like, different shades of brown. I can say, especially among older black relatives that I have, or friends of the family who are maybe from another generation, there was this very open talk, and I now think about how it may have negatively affected my darker skinned cousins or family members.
What was said?
There was a very open talk about how pretty I was, and when I look back on it, I'm like, I don't think they were actually talking about, like,
I mean, you are gorgeous.
I mean, thank you, but I don't think that's what they were talking about.
Right.
I the way that they talked to me was like, I think that, like,
you were preferential because, and you were beautiful because of your skin tone.
Because I was lighter.
Yeah.
And because my hair was a certain way, you know, like, I had good hair. And, like, that kind of conversation is so problematic. Like, that kind of wording is so dangerous.
Yeah.
And I really do felt like there was this kind of, like, idolizing of, and it's so weird because you can have the most proud to be black family members.
Right.
And they'll still idolize this whiteness almost. Like,
right.
You know.
Was that anything that you feel that you were aware of when you were a kid? When did you feel the effects of this? When did this start kind of coming
you know
into
what?
Your consciousness?
It's really fucked up, and I hate to even kind of, like, actually acknowledge this. And
I don't think it is at all, because I think that we've all been raised to believe, at least in our generation, raised to believe what we're speaking about.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me feel shame. Like, I feel shame that, like, I felt this, but I think I felt pretty early on that, like, not, and again, it was messaging that was being given to me.
Right. No,
from,
none,
like,
of us
other,
are saying that you're conceited.
From
that's
other
not
people.
What we're saying.
But it was like, yes, you're special.
Yeah.
Like, not, and again, when you're talking about, it's so complicated, because when you're talking about people of color, like, when you feel unspecial because you're not white, which is what I felt,
and
right?
And then you were made to feel special by
because,
your family.
Yes. So it's like, you feel unspecial because you're not white, and you, in some ways, I wanted to be, right?
Yeah.
And then you're like, okay, but you are special in this space. Like,
and I
right?
think that's how it continues, because it's
right.
it's been passed down through generations of feeling superior and being told that you're superior, even by your darker counterparts.
Yes.
Counterparts,
and
you
it's,
know?
It's so damaging.
Like, you're lucky, you know?
Yeah. And that's fucked up. Like, that, yeah. that thing where people would be like, oh, well, you're so lucky that, like, this is how you look or whatever. And honestly, the more things that made you whiter, the more lucky you were. Like, if you got green yeah. eyes, it was like, oh, good well, for you, you know?
And then I have a question as well for you, because you were raised by a white mother.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever feel a sense of separation within the Black community because you were raised by a white mother? Or did you feel that you were still accepted because of
how you identified? I feel like I was accepted by my family. Because, and this is also fucked up, I mean, it's interesting, like, mixed race families, like, the dynamics are very interesting because I feel like my Black family just didn't talk about it. Like, yeah. and that's why it made it easy to identify as Black, because when
you
I was
were accepted.
When I was with them, I was Black. Like, yeah. there wasn't, I was Black, and I just was Black with good hair and light skin, right? Yeah. Like, they didn't really ever talk about, like,
yeah.
you know, of course, when my mom was around, like, that was a thing, but, like, it wasn't, like, anyone was ever, like, you're half white. When I was with them, I was Black.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So within Black communities, and I also think there has been this kind of normalization of biracial, especially half Black people yeah. as Black. Like, Obama is half white.
Yeah.
But, like,
he was the first Black president.
Halle Berry is half white, and she's yeah. the first Black woman to win a leading, you know,
lead actress
Oscar.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, there. So I think by the time I came around, it was just kind of like, mixed girls are Black.
Yeah. Do you follow Mixed in America on Instagram?
I don't.
They're really great. Max's sister actually, I think she knows the girl who runs it or knows somebody that's involved in it in some way, but it's a great Instagram page, and it's all about being mixed in America, being half Black, half white, and
yeah.
they do amazing posts
yeah.
on Instagram,
and
it's great.
It's a very interesting conversation. It's one I would love to have. I don't want to hijack this episode by talking about
but I think it's interesting to hear what your experience is, because you are kind of in the middle, if you don't mind me saying.
Yeah.
Like, you're kind of, like, you, I feel like,
I'm
can be
dark
a very
enough,
objective person.
Right. I'm dark enough that no one is going to mistake me for being white.
Right.
Right? Like, but I'm not dark enough that I look really, like, dark-skinned
yeah.
at all in any way. And my features aren't so that
right.
it would look like that. Like,
well,
I would probably pass the silhouette test, right? Because I have, like, a long nose and a long face. You
right.
know?
But for me, I don't feel like, I've heard a lot of stories of people who are lighter skinned who are coming out as being allies and discussing maybe their own shortcomings growing up, and that's why I was curious when you started talking about your family, the ways that you perceived
mm-hmm.
that and how that's affected you into adulthood.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's totally on the nose
and,
for colorism.
And I will say yes, and I will say, like, it has been, like I said, like, and this is why I try to have grace with people. Because you don't always have your eyes open
yeah.
to the things that are happening. Like, I was aware of it, mm-hmm. but not aware of it in such a way until I watched that documentary, right?
Right.
Now, that's not to say, like, again, I chose to watch that documentary and educate myself, okay? So, like, everyone needs to do that.
You need to educate yourself. You can't expect the world to educate you on those things
right.
because they're actively working against you knowing
but
information
now,
about
now that.
That
I know, it does make me better equipped to help my dark-skinned brothers and sisters, because, like, they have it harder than me. Like,
yeah.
objectively,
yeah.
they do. And, like, I need to be able to be a good ally for them and like, speak on their behalf
right.
and not try and, like, take over the conversation.
Shine the spotlight on them as you're bringing attention to a certain problem.
Right, because it is harder. And we can talk about the ways in which it is harder.
Yeah.
And why colorism matters so much and
Definitely.
Why it's so insidious. So colorism, it does yield real-world advantages for individuals who have light skin.
Yeah.
For example, and this is moving out of, you know, kind of like we were talking about Black America, but light-skinned Latinx people make $5,000 more on average
mm-hmm.
than dark-skinned Latinx people. And that is from the author of The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives.
Love it.
And there was a Villanova University study of more than than 12,000 African-American women imprisoned in North Carolina, and it found that lighter-skinned black women received shorter sentences.
Yeah, by 11%, actually.
Yeah, wow. I didn't have that number.
Yeah.
And then there was research by Stanford psychologist Jennifer Eberhardt, and she found that darker-skinned black defendants were twice as likely as lighter-skinned black defendants to get the death penalty for crimes involving white victims. So, I mean, and all of that is unconscious bias, right?
It is.
Like, it really is.
I've actually got a list of statistics as well. I got a lot of my information from a website called ThoughtCo. They are one of those websites where you click on one thing, and then it's like, here's another article you might like. Here's another article you
might
like.
The ThoughtCo article was actually good.
It was so good. And then I clicked on one that was just all statistics, and it was giving me some, like, actual numbers that were tangible here. They say that immigrants in general who are lighter skin will make 8 to 15% more than similarly qualified darker-skinned immigrants. Dark-skinned Brazilians make 63% of the poorest sectors in Brazil. Light-skinned black women have a 15% greater probability of marriage. 15% greater probability of marriage. And that made me think of The Bachelor. But I'm also, my head is in Bachelor
world
right now.
Right, I mean, there's a reason why having Rachel as the Bachelorette was a big deal.
Huge deal.
And it wasn't just because she was the first black Bachelorette. It was also because she's a dark-skinned woman.
She is.
And that's, it makes a difference.
It
does.
Really,
because
does.
For so long, black people, black women, dark-skinned black women have had to see success look like Halle Berry or Lena Horne or Dorothy Dandridge, all wonderful ladies.
Yeah.
But, like, they were all light-skinned, very palatable women. Yeah.
Yeah.
To the white community. Let me clarify that.
Right. This was crazy to me that the difference in pay between darker and lighter-skinned men mirrors the pay discrepancy between white and black people.
Mm-hmm.
That's insane.
And that doesn't surprise me at all.
It shouldn't surprise me, but there's something about seeing the numbers and seeing it written down where it's almost like you get all these bits of information and everything is starting to make sense and you're just like, what the fuck?
I just want to take this opportunity right now to also, because I've heard light-skinned or biracial black people talk about how they've been called, like, high yellow, and those things are insulting, and
there's another word I can think of that I don't want to say that starts
mulatto.
That starts with an O. No. I mean, it's a food. It's a cookie. It's America's favorite cookie.
Oreo? Oh, yeah.
I still don't want to say, I'm not going to say it.
Oh,
like,
no,
it's still totally fucking shitty. I'm not going to say it.
I was called an Oreo and all that stuff. It's fine. I mean, it's not fine. But but what I'm getting at, though, is that, like, I've heard, it's kind of like where people are like, well, I've been skinny shamed, so it's just as bad. And I'm like, no, it isn't.
That makes me, we're not going to get into it now, but that makes me so mad.
It's not the same.
It's not the same.
And look, like, don't go and call somebody high yellow in, like, a malicious way, because it's not nice.
I've
to
never
name,
heard that
to
before.
Name call high yellow. It was a name for light skinned slaves back in the day.
When
they were called high yellow because they were, like, high and mighty.
Yeah,
light complected high yellow.
I don't like that.
But no, it's not nice.
No,
but
it's
also,
not. I'm saying,
don't compare. Like, when you go through the struggles and the statistics of the differences between light skin and dark skin, don't go and what about me?
Oh, totally.
This situation.
Totally.
It sucks. Look, nobody make fun of anybody else, but.
Yeah. Also, the last statistic I have is that dark-skinned girls are 3 times more likely to be suspended from school, which makes me mad.
Well, yeah, there is this kind of bias about dark-skinned girls being misbehaved. Like, we kind of assume, it's all of those stereotypes about, like, black women being loud or difficult or strong-willed.
Yeah.
And I think those things get projected onto dark-skinned people.
And isn't that such a bad thing to be strong-willed?
Oh, my gosh. How dare they?
Oh, my gosh. I'm loud and strong-willed.
Yeah,
I wasn't treated as shit. I was suspended in school, though, in 7th grade.
They did get onto me a lot for talking way too much.
I actually got suspended with a darker-skinned boy in my class. I mean, we did get the same punishment.
Well,
but we
progress.
But we shouldn't have gotten suspended. It was for fighting, and we were not fighting.
#progress.
We were, like, enemies, and over that we became, like, best friends, and it was great. So, but yeah, not really progress, but made me think of that.
So there was a 2010 study, and I will pull this clip from YouTube and put it up on our Instagram, probably in preparation for this episode. It's probably in the days before. I look for that on our Instagram. But there was a 2010 study that CNN did where it interviewed young children who were 5, 6, and 7 years old, and it asked them to place values and attributes on people based on their skin tone.
I've seen this video.
And this video makes me want to cry every time
I see it. It's horrible.
Because you watch clips of this study, and again, if you've seen the documentary Dark Girls, it's in that documentary, but the results are just super, super heartbreaking. So in one clip, you see this little dark-skinned girl. She was probably like, I don't know, I want to say she was like 6.
Oh, baby.
Like, little.
Baby
like
girl.
She's a black girl with dark skin, and she's looking at identical drawings with skin tones ranging from light to dark of a girl. So it kind of looks like a doll almost.
Right.
But it's identical. All I've done is changed the skin
tone. Color.
There's probably 6 of them ranging from very light to very dark.
Mm-hmm.
And the researcher asks, point out the smart child. And the child points to the lightest skin drawing. And then the researcher asks, and why is that child smart? And the little girl says, because she's white. And the researcher then asks, show me the dumb child. And the little girl points to the darkest of the drawings. And when asked why she's dumb, the child says, because she's black. And the same thing happens when the researcher says, show me the ugly child. And she points to the black one. And then show me the good-looking child. And she points to the white one. And when asked why, she says, because she's light-skinned.
Yeah.
So these have real lasting effects that start so young.
They do. And actually, I was reading that Lupita Nyong'o, Gabrielle Union, and Kiki Palmer have all spoken out about when they were younger. Like, Lupita Nyong'o has said in interviews that she used to pray to God at night that she would wake up lighter skinned.
And when you hear these stories in Dark Girls, they literally say that. They like, there's one girl who they interview. I don't even think she's young. She's probably a teenager. And she said, when I was a child, I used to wash my face and try and, like, because I thought it was dirt and I wanted to get it off of me. And to some extent, I think I've told the story on this podcast before that, like, I remember one of my earliest memories is sitting in the sandbox with my brother and putting sand on my body because it made, when you brush the sand off, it left a dust that made my skin look lighter. And, like, so these things, they happen to you. You take in this information and it is harmful.
And that's why kids are smarter than you fucking think they are.
They
like
are.
They see everything and they're going to base their prejudice off of what they're told or not told.
Well, and it has real life consequences, as we've just said, like with all those statistics, like it does affect your life. And it's something that you absolutely don't have any control or power
over.
And
this young girl that was in the study you were talking about thinks she's ugly, thinks she's dumb. She could be the most beautiful, smartest girl in the entire planet.
She's fucking adorable.
And
she's so cute.
Yet she thinks that about herself. So what does that mean for her? How is she going to take herself seriously in school? How is she going to take herself seriously in dating?
Yeah. What happens to you when you're a child? It affects your self-esteem for the rest of your life. And then that's compounded by, it's not all in their heads. It's compounded by the fact that, yes, the world is treating you differently.
Yeah.
Like, it's not in your head. Like, you have these issues, I'm sure, self-esteem-wise.
For a reason.
And I follow a lot of, like, YouTubers. And Jackie Aina is a beauty YouTuber who is darker skinned. And she talks about this thing all the time. And I love that she points this out all the time. Because it's also reflected in something so simple or seemingly simple as
makeup,
mm-hmm. not being able to find your shade of foundation.
Oh, when Rihanna came out with her line, it was like
people
revolutionary.
Freaked out because it was like not only were there shades like that went dark enough, but they had a ranging
multitude.
Variety of undertones, right? Like, it's not like dark skin is this monolith that everybody who has dark skin can just be a mocha, you know, foundation shade, and then it's fine.
Yeah.
So it's something so simple that I feel like so many people take for granted is like being able to find makeup that shows up on your skin.
Yeah.
Or that matches your skin.
Yeah.
It's things like that. And And these messages, unfortunately, are still being reinforced today when we look at covers of magazines. Mm-hmm. And we can easily point out that Beyoncé's had her skin lightened, or yeah. Lupita Nyong'o has had her skin lightened.
Or Kim Kardashian has had her skin darkened. What the fuck?
Jesus Christ. Yeah. That shit was ridiculous.
And Kylie. I don't know if I want to read this or if I want you to read this, but I'm sure you read this at some point. There is a horrible childhood rhyme, because we were just talking about...
Oh, yes. Yeah.
We were just talking about that. Uh-huh. I don't really want to read it, because it's really fucking horrible.
I'll read it if you want me to.
Do you want to read it? I just don't want to read it. But this was, in the beginning of the 20th century, it was a popular children's rhyme.
Right. And this was not something that was... I went to a very multicultural elementary school, so this was not a rhyme.
I've never heard this before.
That went on in my school, but I have no doubt that this was something that was definitely said, and something that was definitely said in Black communities, I'm sure. Yeah. If you're Black, stay back. If you're brown, stick around. If you're yellow, stay mellow. If you're right. If you're white, you're all right.
Yeah.
So these kinds of messages were being given to people at such a young age, and they were having to absorb that. They were having to see all of these key figures, or what was considered beautiful in the Black community, being represented by people who were lighter skinned with slighter features. And it has an effect on you. I'm not even dark skinned, and it had an effect on me.
Yeah.
You know, so... It's just something that I think that everybody should keep in mind. And not only is it psychologically damaging, but it is actually physically damaging. Light skin is so coveted that whitening creams are super popular among a lot of different ethnic groups.
Yeah, there's a product sold out of India, and I had it written in my first draft of notes, and it somehow didn't make it into my second. But there is a brand of basically bleaching cream.
Yes.
And it has something like 35 million buyers
exactly
around the world.
Exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, it is so unhealthy. I mean, that goes into like when we were talking about our beauty standards episode, yes. Our unhealthy beauty standards. Yes. Like, it's so dangerous, yet there are multiple millions of people around the world using this cream to lighten their skin.
Yes. So, lightening creams have become bestsellers in the U.S., in Asia, in other nations. Mexican-American women in Arizona, California, and Texas have reportedly suffered mercury poisoning after using whitening creams to bleach their skin. In India, popular skin bleaching lines target both women and men with dark skin, and skin bleaching cosmetics persist after decades. And it's just kind of this example of this, like, enduring legacy of colorism.
Yeah.
And because it's Black History Month, I really wanted to focus on the origins of colorism within the Black community and the effects of it and and its continuance. I do think at some point we should make an effort to focus on other cultures, because this, I'll tell you, I was in South Korea. This shit is fucking everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
You can't go anywhere in South Korea, in Seoul. You can't go into, like, any beauty shop, which the beauty industry in Korea is
huge, massive.
And so when I was in Korea, I was like,
I'm going to get me some of this stuff.
I bought snail cream.
Oh, I would have done everything.
Give me all the shit, because I'm in South Korea and, like, this is what you do here.
That's what I would do.
So I did. I went into a lot of beauty shops and I bought things, and every single place had advertisements, very blatant, whiten yourself, whitening cream, don't you want to be white, like everything did. And it's a major, major issue. And I remember watching a video where it was people of different nationalities who were all dark skin according to their nationality. So there was like a dark skin woman from India, a dark skin woman from Korea, et cetera, et cetera. And all talking about their experiences. And it's all awful.
We can do a part two. I'm totally here for it.
Yeah, maybe after
Women's History Month.
Yes, we'll do a part two that's talking about colorism worldwide. But it's and the histories of it in these different cultures are fascinating. I think that the history of it in the United States is particularly fascinating because it's so closely tied to slavery. In other cultures, it exists, and it exists for different reasons, very often because light-skinned people were inside while dark-skinned people were peasants working outside.
Right, and it's a sign of superiority in class, nobility, and higher status, and education.
And that mentality has just persisted regardless of whether or not it makes any sense.
Well, and it's horrible because you're raised to believe that in order to get a better job, in order to get a better education, you need to do those things, so you're willing to put yourself at risk if that means giving yourself a better life.
Well, I mean, yes.
I don't know how that's going to stop.
And it's not just giving yourself a better life. It's along the same lines and, like, you know, forgive me for, like, for making this kind of comparison, but it's the same way that people will do dangerous things to be thin.
Yep.
Right? It's the same way that people will do dangerous... We had a whole episode about, like, dangerous beauty trends, because whatever it is that makes... Because at the end of the day, being attractive by society's narrow definition of what that means makes your life easier. And if you can do that, I think a lot of people don't really care about, like, the damage.
Why would you make your life harder when you can make your life easier?
Right, then they don't care about the damage. You know what I mean?
But much like what you just said, when we talk about diet culture, I don't know how it's ever going to stop. I don't know how...
No. Without society making some kind of enormous change, it won't ever stop.
And that's the thing that's frustrating, is because these companies are making blood money, really. The diet companies, the companies that are selling whitening creams, it's they know what they're doing.
Yeah, Black China was the she had her own whitening cream. She came under fire for that, like, a couple years ago.
Fuck.
Because she was selling it in Africa, because it's a huge thing.
I bet
in parts of Africa, and
it's that thing where it's like, we talk about a problem without me being able to tell you what I think a solution would be. And that's something that's hard for me to do. Whenever we talk about a problem, I like to think about what a solution could be, and I don't think that there is one.
Well, okay, so if we want to end this on kind of maybe a bit of an uplifting note, since it is Black History Month, and that was the focus mostly of this episode, I will say, not that I want to be the spokesperson for the Black community, but I will say...
What?
The Black community.
In this room.
in this closet. That I think what it's going to take from the Black community is solidarity, right?
Yeah.
Like, we need to stop it.
Yeah.
everybody within the Black community, we need to stop having this very narrow view. And I like that we've started to see it with things like hair love, where we just talked about that in the mini episode where there is this natural hair movement, and there's these other things happening that are saying, like, this is just as beautiful.
Yeah.
And, like, we need to refocus and change our definition of what beautiful is, and we need to support each other. Because as sad as it is, I think that people of color expect people outside of their group to say things about them.
Right.
It hurts more when people within your group are saying those things.
Yeah.
So as a Black community, I think that that's kind of step one.
Yeah.
Is like, we gotta fucking shut that shit down.
Right. And I think in general, what I have written as the last thing in my notes is, no matter what your race or ethnicity or background is just teach kids that there is no skin color that is inherently wrong or bad. And that's hard to do because you can, as a, you know, I take care of a child for a living, and you can say something to a kid a million times and they get it. It's different to have them actually follow through with it when everything in society is pushing against you.
Yes.
And I, you know, this month, I've spent a lot of time with the child that I take care of, doing research about Black History Month and learning about people that he didn't know about. I talked with him about colorism before, because he always wants to know what we're going to talk about. And for me, that was an important conversation to have. and asking him questions about do you think there are skin tones that are bad? What are your thoughts? What makes you think that? And I know I'm talking to a child. He is very, I mean, children are very emotionally smart. Like, they really, really are. And it was a great conversation for me to have with him. And it was eye-opening to me as well, also to be researching this and also to be exploring things in Black History Month that I didn't know about that I'm then learning with him. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, everything comes back to the next generation. We always hope that the next generation is going to be better than the one that we're in now. And if there is a way that we can convince our children and convince the children that they're, that your skin tone does not mean that you are different than anybody else as far as your worth and your superiority.
Or your capability.
Like, that's important because we have to start changing that prejudice.
Right. Yeah. And I think that a good way to do that, or something to just keep in mind, would be to mentally check yourself. Like, we've had this conversation on this podcast many times, but there are unconscious biases that happen just because we live in a society that has told us something forever, right? And so it is a challenge to every one of us to stop ourselves.
Yep.
To examine our thoughts, and then proceed, right? Like, because you could be passing shit on. And I say this coming from a Black family, like, I think that they passed things on, without meaning to. Like, they weren't meaning to do damage, right?
To you, but, or like, your cousins or anything.
But. Yes, but, like, they did. And so it's just something to be very conscious of.
Right, and I think, you know, I've said this a million times on this show, but again, it is not the first thought that you think, it is your corrective thought.
Yeah, that's exactly
that
right.
That makes you the person that you are. It's not the first thought that you have, because I've beaten myself a lot up about that in the past.
Yes, of course.
And when I learned that, I finally was able to realize that I'm bettering myself when I correct own unconscious bias.
Yeah. So. And we will definitely, I'll make sure to label this episode so that people
know it's a part one.
Understand. Yeah. That this is, we are talking about mostly colorism within the African-American community as part of our series on Black History Month. We will do a follow-up episode, or maybe like a bonus mini episode or something, because I don't know if we'll fill another hour talking about it, but we can definitely do another episode where we discuss this in other cultures. So if it is something that you have experienced within your culture, I definitely want to hear about it, because I know it exists, and I know that there are especially complicated dynamics in Latinx cultures where there are maybe like Black Latinx people who have to experience very intersectional, interwoven kind of forms of discrimination.
Yeah.
So I would love to hear from you about that. So if you have anything that you want to reach out to us about, or if you feel like there was something in this episode that we didn't talk about, please, please reach out to us. Our email is neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com. You can also find us on Instagram, where I will be posting that heartbreaking video.
Yeah.
At Angry Neighborhood Feminist. You can get us on Twitter for now at YANF Podcast, YANF Podcast. You can also find us on Facebook. We have a group and a business page. Feel free to leave us a review on our business page or on Apple Podcasts. We love hearing from you. And you can also listen to us on Radio Public. You know it by now. And I think that's all we got, right?
That's all we got for now, you guys. Thank you so much for listening. With all that being said, we encourage you to rage on.
Bye. Cheers.
Cheers. Wow, I like it.
It's a crossover.
I know it's a crossover, but thanks for bringing it in.